Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. We are joined today by the author and book editor, Roderick Tweedy, who's here to talk to us about his book, The God of the Left Hemisphere. The book explores the remarkable connections between the activities and functions of the human brain that writer William Blake termed urizen and the powerful complex of rationalizing and ordering processes which modern neuroscience identifies as left hemisphere brain activity. Blake's prescient insight into the nature and origins of this arguably dominant force within the brain allows him to radically reinterpret the psychological basis of the entity commonly referred to as God. Hello, Rod. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, Barry. Thanks for inviting me here.
Okay, well, could you begin by telling us maybe something about yourself and how you first became interested in William Blake?
I studied English at Oxford. I did a DPhil on Shelley, actually, at the time, investigating Shelley's interest in science, his interest in chemistry and electricity. So that was kind of the first hint of my sort of interest in integrating these two ways of seeing the world. And for me, Shelley was a transformational figure in that, his sort of radical fusions of poetry and electricity and the things that he was doing, I thought was just very fascinating, very timely. And I also read Blake at the time at university, and I remember being very struck by how unusual and powerful his work was. And I think, like many people, parts of Blake, they stick with you like a sort of burr in the mind, and you think, what is going on here? It's sort of mind-blowing, some of his ideas. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite.
Yeah.
These really sort of striking sayings that you can't immediately work out, but sound intriguing and, you know, kind of right in some way. So I remember being very, kind of having my mind blowing by him, and I talked to my teacher and said, you know, I find Blake mind-blowing. And he said, that's okay, you're young enough to have your mind blown. But Blake's still blowing my mind. But I realised there was something there that I would have to get back to. And it was only about 20 years later that I really found the time to reconnect with Blake and explore more of his vision, which is something I knew I wanted to do. So I was doing that. And then I came across this TED podcast by Jill Balty Taylor about the hemispheres and how she was talking about these two different modes of perception or apprehension of the world really struck a powerful chord and made a connection. I just instantly, something she said connected with the whole of how Blake was seeing things. So I started to develop that, just it's quite a simple idea.
And what was that thing? What was the thing that she said? Can you remember?
I can remember the moment, yeah. It's where she says there are these two Jill Balty Taylors, these two I ams. And there's this one, which is the, how she sees it, the right hemisphere, where she's connected to all the energy of the universe, and she's part of this one big family, and the energy, the beautiful, peaceful energy of the universe, and where everything is a flow. And then she can stand back from that with the left hemisphere. And then she's, you know, Jill Balty Taylor, the successful Harvard neuroanatomist, and it can say, I am. You know, and just the way she said it, in the Bible, God famously says, I think it's the book of Exodus, I am that I am.
Yeah.
And Coleridge have talked about this as a very powerful moment. And so I thought, well, it's a connection with the left hemisphere and that kind of God voice or character or power. And Coleridge was quite favourable towards that voice, but Blake wasn't. He thought it was a usurping God,
yeah,
which he calls urizen, and represents rationalising processes. And again, I thought, well, that's very interesting that this sort of rationalising power was connected again with what Jill was saying about the left hemisphere. So all these things started to kind of unfurl, and I kind of pursued that more and more.
Okay, and so that basically was the trigger for the book.
That was the trigger, and so I wrote half the book, and then at that point I came across Ian McGilchrist's work,
okay,
The Master and His Emissary, about 2 years later perhaps, and that was really opened another door. It's a, for me, it's one of the most remarkable books I've read, and I think one of the most important books in the last 100 years that's changed so many people's ways of understanding reality, and the way that the brain is engaged with that.
Okay. And just for, say, the uninitiated listeners, what is his interpretation of brain lateralization, and then how does that connect with Blake's work?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there's so many misunderstandings about lateralization. It was discredited in the 70s and 80s, I think everyone knows, because it became very sort of pop psychology, pseudoscience about it. So no one would touch it, apart from Ian. And his work was really drawing on animal lateralization, and there's fascinating research in the 90s and about how animal brains also have this dual form of attention. And I think the word attention is absolutely the crucial word and insight that Ian brings to this. These two modes of attention that we have that are allowed us, and one is a very narrow focused attention, and one is a very broad, vigilant, open, receptive form of attention. And it's kind of wonderful that we have this choice and this option of complementary realities. For example, one of his models of that, way to get your head around it, is sort of birds who are pecking at grains of corn or food with one eye. Most people, I think, have seen that. Yeah. They tilt their eye and look at something very focused, and they know what they want, and they've already chosen what they want, and they're going to get it. And it's a very detailed, narrow form of engagement with the world to use it. And the other eye is looking out for anything else, predators, mates, whatever's coming. It's a very open form of reception. And he's saying, in evolutionary terms, it's very successful to have those twin things going along, and they're sort of incompatible. It's like rubbing your head and rubbing your stomach at the same time. So we need this kind of split, perhaps, between those two hemispheres to allow us these two quite distinct and in some ways incompatible modes of engagement, but they're both beneficial and give something to us.
So, am I right in saying, Rod, that there's this band of fibres between the two hemispheres called the corpus callosum, and this is the bridge that helps the two hemispheres to communicate with each other. But my understanding from McGilchrist's work is that the left hemisphere is better at inhibiting the right hemisphere via the corpus callosum. Is that the reason why the left hemisphere becomes dominant? Is that how it does it?
I think it's part of the mechanism of that quality. The left hemisphere itself is quite a domineering. It wants to take control of the world, which is immensely useful. It's the kind of developments of tools and the right-handedness. So it's interested in domination, which can be wonderful, but it also can obviously lead to over-domination. And the corpus callosum is this very interesting part of the brain, where it both bridges these two modes of attention and also, as you say, inhibits. And you would think, you know, perhaps to have a more integrated world, we need to strengthen that bridge and the integration. But one of its main functions, as you say, is to inhibit, to choose which hemisphere is best for something. And as you're saying, McGilchrist explains that when we receive new experience or information about the world, it's really through the right hemisphere, which attends to what's new and different and open. So it comes through our right hemisphere, which is therefore often sort of more creative and more open to new possibilities and open to the idea of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. It's more okay with that. And then it gets passed to unpack by the left hemisphere, which analyses, takes the details and the details of the details, as Dilwati Taylor says, to build up this wonderful kind of abstract map of reality. Sort of cognitive app par excellence. But then often the problem is, as McGilchrist sort of shows in wonderful detail throughout various stages of history, it can become trapped in that hemisphere, that side, and it fails to get returned to the right hemisphere, which is what would happen normally or healthily, to be returned to the bigger picture for the sort of the value of that analysis to really take hold and be used constructively and creatively in a wider context. So it is fascinating what is going wrong with that unpacking. I think he uses the word from Hegel, Aufhebung, or this process of where it's meant to go from right to left to right, the sort of synthesis.
Yeah.
And at the moment gets stuck in the left hemisphere, and that leads to an awful lot of problems that he talks about, and mental health problems, devitalization, and paranoia and anxiety, because it's It reminds me of Star Trek 1, the film, where V'ger, I think, is this sort of space thing machine that goes out to collect information, but it can't download it in the end. So all this stuff, it becomes sort of monstrous and destructive because there's no way of downloading or integrating that insight.
Right.
And I think people do suffer from sort of left hemisphere dominant problems or issues that are associated with that inability to reintegrate.
And so how does all this relate to Blake?
Yeah, Blake was onto that, I think. Remarkable, sort of 200 years ago, just as the Industrial Revolution and the Enlightenment was taking off and everyone was celebrating the power of reason and rationality and instrumentality, immensely powerful insights and knowledge that it can give us through its mode of engaging with the world and using it. So everyone was kind of applauding it, but he was saying, no, this is already going too far and it's taking control. It's becoming too dominant. It's not recognizing all the other forms of skill and information like emotional intelligence and imagination and intuition. All these things were being eroded. The picture kind of just limiting to this one thing it could do very well, which is use the world. And so it's amazing that he was onto that. And maybe it's because he was living right in the heart of it, in London and the centre of the storm. And he kind of recognised what was going on. And now I think, how I would see it, is he's being vindicated. And it's fascinating how neuroscience is, I think, is corroborating his take on the world. And that was so useful for Jill Botti-Taylor and Ian McGilchrist, who also talks about Blake in his book, to illuminate what Blake was talking about. And the other thing I want to do is the reverse of that, to use Blake to illuminate neuroscience and suggest where it might be going wrong, where it's very too limited in its machine models, for example, and what Blake can give us in that discussion. Yeah.
And this left hemisphere dominance, is that demonstrated in a way by Blake, by Urizen? Who is Urizen, or what is Urizen? Where does that name come from, and what are its origins?
Yes, where does Urizen come from? I think it's a fantastic word. One of the genius things about Blake is the humour and the insight and the intelligence. And just with that one word, Urizen, it's sort of a pun on your reason.
Right.
And also perhaps on the Greek word meaning horizon, because that what he's referring to, what I would call sort of the left hemisphere take on the world, is all about limiting things, often in very useful ways. But that's his word for this powerful complex or activity. I mean, he refers to it in mythological terms as a sort of a being, but he also says it's an activity, it's a process, it's an interlocked number of functions and activities in the brain. He always locates it very much in the brain, which is very striking for modern readers. So it's connected to the moralizing programs and the information processes, ordering, dividing the universe. That's a very strong characteristic for him of Urizen.
Okay. Yeah. And then, one of the pictures that we most associate with Blake is the Ancient of Days, a picture of what we assume to be God, actually. Is he sat on a cloud and holding a pair of dividers at right angles? But that is actually Urizen, isn't it?
It's one of Blake's depictions of this power that he associates with Urizenic activity, and he paints Newton, sort of the great scientist, in a very similar position, interestingly enough, with dividing the universe with these golden compasses in his left hand, also like the Ancient of Days, to draw this connection of this underlying activity, and to question what sort of God this is. As you say, people would point to it and think automatically maybe that simply represents God. So it's I think Blake has to be quite careful in his depictions when he's trying to make us question these very powerful figures and symbols that we have, ways of conceiving the world, dominant constructs. And for him, Urizen is this dominant construct, this idea that God is a dividing activities and ordering activities, a rationalizing activity, imposing order on the world, and it's quite a dominating figure, kind of looking down and doing all that. And Newton sort of does the same thing, at least in Blake's picture of it. So it's I think that's why it's so resonant, because it appeals to our sense of this authority figure, and yet it sort of subverts it by saying, is that really the best way, the dominant way of seeing reality, or is something going wrong with this?
And then Blake points out again and again that Urizen and indeed these tendencies and perhaps all deities are located in the human brain.
Yeah, it's one of his most striking features of his verse, that he constantly refers to the human brain and Urizen. There's a quotation in Blake, "Though in the brain of man we live, where Urizen and all his starry hosts hang their immortal lamps." But this idea that all of these beings that he's referring to are generated or mediated through the human brain in particular,
yeah.
And the word brain has a significance for him that it really doesn't for any of the other romantic writers.
Right.
And he sees all these powers and agencies, other religions call them daemons and spirits, and as sort of these partly neurological activities and partly something beyond that.
And I imagine this could easily have got him into a lot of trouble at the time.
Yeah.
How did he avoid that?
Escape. It was partly he was very poor and on the margins, and he was sort of a working class or lower middle class artisan. He was an engraver, and he's very much off the radar. So, in a way, that protected him a little bit. But he was put on trial for sedition in 1803. He was aware of the dangers of espousing directly radical ideas. Some of his friends were put in prison. There was one of his publishers, Joseph Johnson, was imprisoned in the 1790s. It was a very difficult time for anyone who was progressive and like Blake was. And he also used this slightly obscure mythology to both conceal or make it more be less direct about his points. So he's encoding it in these parables and the metaphors,
right.
In very interesting ways that can be unpacked later, I think.
Okay, and I suppose the context for Blake's writing, well, to use an expression of yours, was very Urizenic. What events were occurring in his day to engender that?
Yeah, there was a lot going on, and he relates it not only to this sort of psychological aspect, but he saw Urizen, as he called it, this left brain dominant stance at work throughout society in different forms, which I think makes it very rich and sort of powerful as a key to unlock some of these things. For example, the war on terror. Britain was at war with France and post-revolutionary France, the first war on terror. But people like Thomas Paine was considered a terrorist, or anyone who supported the war. So it's a very sort of modern time in that sense, and dangerous time. And he saw the same sort of domineering, analytic, functionalist, instrumentalist attitude in a work within Britain, within the economic system and industrialisation, treatment of the poor, ordinary citizens, and within religion and within science itself, as being formed by this over-rationalising process that we have, which is potentially useful, but had become destructive for human happiness, and lots of ways, wars and misery and oppression and those features. And he relates it to that power of the brain that has become unbalanced.
And so, who or what is God, according to Blake?
In his terms, I think he would say it's a mode of perception. And we're so used to thinking of God in traditional ways as a thing or a person or an object. But like many other religions, I think they suggest it isn't that. And for him, it's to do with relationships and empathy and compassion. Forgiveness is a huge part of Blake's sort of spiritual understanding of life and the way that God, for him, is manifest. He says at one point in his text, Jesus or God is saying this, "I am not a God afar off, I am a brother and a friend. I am in you and you in me, mutual in love divine." So it's expressed in this universe for him through caring and relationships, what Ian McGilchrist calls the betweenness of things, is something apprehended, I think, through the right hemisphere in such forms as imaginative compassion, imaginative understanding, creativity, intuition, and connectedness, attachment theory today, and all those things to do with the body and how we relate to other people. I think he would understand that in, as potentially divine and connecting in a profound way.
Okay. And then I'm just thinking also about philosophy here. How is Plato's world Eurycenic?
In the book I compare some of these other figures of the dominant construct, god-type figures, and Plato is a great source for that. The Timaeus, so this creation myth. And again, we see the same processes. I compare it in the book to what we see in the book of Genesis. Plato conceives this universe as being ordered, reduced into order, as he puts it, and divided into day and night, and the planets and the sort of construction of time itself. Blake was very familiar with Plato and would have got a lot from that, his understanding of people like that. And also in other mythologies, Blake refers to the Norse mythologies and in the Greek stories of the Titans versus the sky gods. And that's a really interesting, again, sort of variation of this idea that the sky gods were rather like Euros in the sky, in the head, dominating, imposing law and order and through morality, and they have staffs and they're at war with these other kind of much more bodily giants that are always associated with the body and subconscious forces that were defeated. Right. But in lots of the mythologies, the giants will rise again, and again, that's like Prometheus, and will challenge the reign of these rather sterile, authoritarian powers.
Yeah, and I think one thing that really struck me, what Blake said, was that what Eurism really wants is to feel alive. Is that the sort of basic problem? Is he in some way Eurism envious of the right hemisphere?
I think he's sort of aware that he's in a map, and that's very frustrating. He's generated, I say he, but you know, that we're all, I think, susceptible to the vision, to the processes of rationalisation, which is why so many of us, I think, feel devitalised. McGilchrist talks about devitalisation as one of the key sort of experiences of the left hemisphere, and I know many people today experience that. In the process of abstracting yourself from the moment, from reality, from the embodied existence, which is all the good things that Eurozone does, or the left brain does, and allows us to stand back. But if you only stand back, and as you were saying earlier, don't reconnect again and deliver it back to the right hemisphere, to the imaginative sort of sense of context, then you'll become entrapped in this virtual world. McGilchrist calls it the Hall of Mirrors, this sort of very self-referential, very useful sort of map-like world, but it is a dead world, and that's the price it pays, I think, for becoming king. You become sort of king of this desolated kingdom, and so how do you reconnect again with the earth, with reality, with feelings, and all the things that actually generate life, I think.
So in some way, does the left hemisphere see the right hemisphere as the devil, or as evil, or...?
I think insofar as that, historically, the body, which the right hemisphere is very much in touch with and represents and articulates, has been demonised, and it's been demonised consistently. Blake is so good on showing this. Demonised by Plato, and the idea that the body is this kind of either irrational force that's always trying to trip us up, or unreal in some way, it's not the ultimate reality. And again, in the church, demonised the body and the forces, I think, again, through the right hemisphere. And perhaps worst of all, in modern science, the body is no longer even a demon or an animal. It's a machine, and which is the ultimate degradation, I think. So this whole attack from all these dominant ideologies, and Blake again draws the connection between Enlightenment materialist science, Newtonian science, attack on the body, churches attacking the body, Plato's attacking the body, to show that all of their kind of gods and ways of thinking are very similar. And if you compare that to the imagination and the divinity of the body, then you realise how much they have in common, in fact, and how we need to recorrect that vision.
When you say have in common, the realms of religion and science.
Yes. For Blake, it's one of his most challenging and, I think, insightful ideas, is that although we're told this popular idea of the two cultures, the religion and science, are at loggerheads, for him, they're just variations in lots of ways of the same thing, the same operating system.
Yeah.
But Newton, they're based on the idea of ordering and rationalizing and dividing, and they value all those things. And people like I talk about in the book about Galileo, who was very religious, and he shared the idea of the Pope, of the idea that God was rational, and he was so grateful to God for revealing to him his God's language, which he said was in mathematics and geometry. So this, it wasn't at all an opposition as it's usually sold. It was more like an upgrading of the operating system that he was given. And so this idea of, you know, the battle between reason and science, I think is a bogus one. It's rather like Mac versus PC. And I think Freud talks about this in terms of the narcissism of small differences, that the closer you are, in some way, the more angry you get with your people who are quite similar. You see this on the left wing politics, you know. And Blake again allows us to stand back and actually point to the similarities, I think, of these systems.
Yeah. Okay.
Sort of one left brain system being replaced by another.
So then Blake saw the real clash then, not between religion and reason, but between rationality and imagination?
Yes. Imagination, yes, the imaginative view of reality, which I think rationality dismisses and doesn't really understand and would like to belittle. It will call it wishful thinking and just poetic fancy. And so I think Blake is one of the key people who defends the imaginative vision and shows both how valuable it is and also how, if you apply rationality to rationality itself, it sort of deconstructs. McGilchrist does it rather beautifully in his book to apply the kind of enlightenment to the enlightenment project. And what is grounding it is something other than what it pretends to be. It's often beliefs that ground it and hopes and things like that, and what it wants the world to be like.
Okay, so there's also a very, very much a positive side to Blake's work with his vision of the integration of the left hemisphere with the right. First of all, maybe what's going on there? How does he envision that? And well, is that what he meant by the marriage of heaven and hell?
I think so, in part. And it's the marriage of heaven and hell is a wonderful text, and maybe something very useful to the Middle Way Society. I mean, it'd be wonderful to have a workshop exploring the connections and how that might relate to what the Middle Way Society is doing. Because Blake absolutely is interested in the idea of reconciling and integrating these two modes of understanding the world and relating to it, which he does discuss in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. One of his insights or ways of entering that debate, I think, is to appreciate the importance of contraries in life. There's a section in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell where he says, without contraries is no progression. We need love and hate, attraction and repulsion, good and evil, are all necessary for human existence or any existence. So it's sort of a yin and a yang idea that these two polarities are fundamental to existence, and we can't. It's the mistake, and sometimes dangerous or destructive of happiness and well-being, to only emphasise or focus on one, even a kind of good one, light. Lots of people deify light and they don't deify darkness. And without darkness, there's no depth, and the light often represents, I think, the Eugenic sort of relentless spotlight, which is why it's attracted to the symbol of light, because it sort of represents rationality. But on the other hand, Blake defends, you know, the body. He calls it the voice of the devil, being the devil's advocate, really. There's these wonderful gnomic sayings, the proverbs of hell, that so many people like in Blake. The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. And on the surface of it, that seems to challenge, for example, the idea of perhaps the middle way and moderation. But I think he's saying we need to appreciate all aspects of life, you know, the left and the right hemisphere, vision and imagination and reason and analysis. And we have to develop them both and not sort of shackle them and not allow one to oppress the other. And in these terms, I think, again, Ian's book on the hemispheres is so important. He's talking about asymmetry, not symmetry, and recognising the value of these two separate modes, but also recognising that ultimately, for the reasons he unpacks, that one is more useful at grounding. It's the right hemisphere, the imaginative, the contextual that's related to the body and the imagination, that I think is the one that should be referred to. And what we were saying earlier about, again, that the left hemisphere is, in our cultures, is not so good at returning the information to the right hemisphere, is the problem. And perhaps the middle way can help that sort of integration and that kind of balance.
Okay. Yeah. To what degree do you think Blake himself was integrated?
I think hugely. He's always had this reputation of being mad, and there's that. It's a great, interesting discussion. But I think what was remarkable about him was his unusual sanity, and that one of the first lives of Blake, the life by Gilchrist in the 19th century, the people who knew him referred to him as being this very sort of gentle, together person. And in terms of these extraordinary visions he had, seeing things and hearing voices, and his visionary capacity, hearing his dead brother and painting the architect of the pyramids, and these extraordinary people he sort of saw in his imagination, was that he was able to control these visions, and so many people can't control their demons. And I think that's quite significant, and suggests that he wasn't mad, that he was very strongly grounded in his vision. And I think that also allowed him to stand back and see what was going on in society and see all these shifts going on, which rather terrified him, into the dissociations, the devitalization, the domineering, because he wasn't involved in it directly. I think his sanity kind of protected him. And maybe one of the reasons I talk about in the book was he was kind of fortunate enough not to have been formally educated in this country. And I think our education process sort of hammers out our right hemisphere. There's some fascinating research by Roger Sperry in the 70s. He's a Nobel Prize winning scientist on his split brain research, saying that experiments show that most children before they enter school score rank very highly creatively, which he associates with the right hemisphere. But by the age of 7, only 10% do, and by the age of when they leave school, only 2% rank as creative. So he's saying there's this huge discrimination against one whole half of our brain. And that resonates very much with Blake's idea as well, I think, and the need to reintegrate.
And, well, just sticking with imagination, do you think, well, you obviously think that Blake is still very much relevant today in that he can enable people to access perhaps the middle way from more intuitive, imaginative perspective?
Yeah, I was very interested in the middle way. He's interested in exploring the imagination as a way of reconciling some of these things and allowing some of these fusions and states to come into being. That relates, I think, to the concern as well that you have in the middle way society and Blake has with dogmatic thinking, black and white thinking and absolutes. And Blake is very critically minded, and the whole of his work is really to get us to question. He constantly repaints his pictures so there's not one authoritative version of it. And as we've seen in the picture of the Ancient of Days, it's to subvert and get us to question what we think we know about reality, and to elevate, therefore, the middle ground, the messy grey area of embodied lived existence, which is uncertain and kind of terrifying at times because we're thrown into this world. And so the attraction of certainties and people who promise certainties is very great.
Yeah.
We'll always get a big audience. But it deadens our world and it becomes destructive. It's very important to hold on to ambiguity.
Yeah, sure. He's not always an easy read, though, Blake, especially his more prophetic works. If people are interested in dipping their toe with Blake, what advice would you give people to get started, maybe?
Well, his most famous poems are a wonderful introduction, The Songs of Innocence and Experience, London, The Tiger, The Sick Rose. And for me, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell is his key text to sum up especially his early life, and one of the grooviest books ever written. It's influenced so many people, opened so many doors. So that's a really good way, and it's a combination of poetry and prose, so you get an insight of the coherence of his framework as well. It's just indications. I'm hoping, the later work is difficult and challenging. I think we'll probably need another 100 years to appreciate it. I think he was so ahead of his time, and we're just beginning to get there through ideas of hyperlinks and multi-perspectivity that he's playing with, and non-linear sequences. So just as it's taken 200 years to kind of get a handle on what he was going on about and realising it wasn't insane, there's an unusual sanity there, I think we'll need more time. But I do think this in McGilchrist's work, and hopefully my book will help people open up some of Blake's later works through this idea of understanding of the left hemisphere, rationalisation, and the role of Eurozone. And then some of the other things, I think, fall into place a bit more clearly around that.
Okay, and both your book and McGilchrist's book, and arguably Blake and his work, are a warning in a way that living in this world that is quite left hemisphere dominant. But do you see a time, or do you see any hope for the right hemisphere, the master, if you want, you know, finding a more equal relationship with left hemisphere again? Do you see any signs of that?
I do. I think the success of McGilchrist's book, the resonance of his message, and so many other people, Eckhart Tolle, I talk a lot about Tolle's understanding of the ego and the selfhood. Blake refers constantly to the selfhood as this pathological entity. And again, it's taken, I think, 200 years for the West to catch up. After 100 years of Freud kind of seeing very positively the idea of the ego, I think we're wary of it now. And this shift that's going on, many people are talking about this sort of awakening or a paradigm shift. McGilchrist talks about it. I think it's happening in politics. It's a very uncertain time, but I see indications of a kind of return to the right hemisphere, which is more relational and community-based, in the politics of people like Jeremy Corbyn, as well as the mindfulness and the appeal of certain forms of Buddhism today. I see that all as indicating a resonance today with these kinds of ideas, and a dissatisfaction with the previous paradigm that we've been sold. And I think Blake is a really crucial figure for unlocking that.
Okay. Well, I hope so too. How would you prefer your book to be read, Rod? Just as an interpretation of Blake, or also as a kind of interdisciplinary philosophy that uses Blake as a medium of presentation?
I hope both. I'm a passionate defender of Blake. He's been knocked so many times, and I hope the book will help illuminate a lot of his work and show how coherent and compelling it is. You know, rather as McGilchrist and other people have come to the defence of the right hemisphere, I hope I've come to the defence of Blake and his vision, which shares so much in common, I think, with the right hemisphere's take on the world. But I also think Blake provides us with this, it's the most profound framework I've ever come across myself, and so you can apply that to so many things, which is why in the second half of the book I talk about psychopathy and economic institutions and science and religion today, and wars, and the wider picture, really, because it's simply a framework in the way that perhaps Buddhism and the Middle Way Society is, to apply to lots of different situations, including itself, and to think critically. Mm-hmm. I hope people will take that away from it as well, and start thinking about how our own dominant constructs and belief systems, and how to live a more integrated life in that way.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Rod. It's been fascinating and a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you, Barry.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.